10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's program is a rebroadcast of one of our favorite morning show interviews from 2018. On today's morning show, we are going to be talking about a real-life adventure, which was experienced by a young woman that I know very, very well. I happen to be one of her godparents. Her name is Annika Barrow. And some of you may know either her mother, Kate Potter Barrow, or her father, Jeff Barrow. Actually, both of them have been part of the morning show. But this is Annika's turn to be on the program and to tell us about an experience that she had now. By this point, it's been more than a year she spent nearly a year in the nation of Mexico. And the reason I wanted to bring Annika onto the program, I wanted to do it as soon as she returned, but life just got in the way. But it feels almost more timely to talk about her experience now, because part of what Annika did in Mexico with an organization called Young Adults in Global Mission was to work with refugees who were fleeing Latin American countries like Honduras, making their way into Mexico, through Mexico, with the hopes of someday getting all the way to the border with the United States. And needless to say, we are grappling now mightily with the whole issue of immigrants, illegal immigrants, refugees, the crises in various countries. And Annika has been right in the thick of that in a way that most of the rest of us cannot even really imagine. And so I'm very excited to explore with Annika the experience that she had there and to see what her perspective is on some of these really vexing questions. Annika Barrow, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
I am really, really excited about this. And recently I've been rereading the wonderful a blog that you kept during that time in Mexico, sort of leading up to it and then afterwards. And we'll be sure to give people the address of that before we're done if people want to explore that as I have. Say a word about Young Adults in Global Mission, what its mission is and where it tends to dispatch young people.
So Young Adults in Global Mission is a program of the ELCA. It's commonly known as YAGM. It's easier to say than the full thing. And so YAGM's mission is to send young adults between the ages of 21 and 29 out into the world into 14 different countries. And YAGM runs on what we call an accompaniment model, which means that we're not going to fix anything or evangelize or anything like that. We are going to accompany the people in the communities that we are serving, and we're going to be with them and learn from them and immerse ourselves fully in their life and their community.
Hmm. So it's not that you come in with answers that they might not have. You are working side by side with them in whatever it is that they might need.
Yes.
And I know that a good friend of yours, Laura Hermans, was part of YAGM, I think, the previous year.
Yes.
Dispatched to Rwanda. What is the process by which she was sent to Rwanda and you were sent to Mexico? I mean, how are those choices made?
So you apply to the program and then you are invited to interview with two country programs. And at the end of the two interviews, you can write on a note card which one you want to go to, but ultimately it will be their decision. And you sit in a room and they say everyone's name in alphabetical order matched with a country, and then you know what country you're going to, and then you get your country assignment and your host assignment and all of that. But you really, you have to give up control, because you can preference countries and say, ah, I feel a leaning towards this one, but ultimately the decision is out of your hands of country placement, all of that.
Right. So even within Mexico, there are various places to which you could be assigned, and you basically have no control over that.
Correct.
So Mexico was one of the countries. What was the other?
I interviewed for the Argentina-Uruguay program.
Ah, so you were really committed to speaking Spanish.
Yes.
Understood. What was it that was fueling this interest in being part of YAGM, besides of hearing from Laura and maybe other people who had had great experiences, but for you very specifically and personally, what was the hunger that this was perhaps going to satisfy?
Well, after I graduated college, I worked at a desk job for a marketing, in marketing for a property management company, and I was 21 and sitting at a desk and thought, this can't be all that's out there. And so I chose to apply to YAGM, which was a program that my dad actually had really grown to love as bishop, and kind of had been saying, Annika, you have to do YAGM, you have to do YAGM. And I was just sitting at that desk one day, and I opened the application and I said, this is right. And there's a lot more to life than sitting in a desk.
Hmm. So I want to read something that is in one of your blog entries that I really, really like. You wrote, when I look at my most rewarding, fulfilling, life-changing moments, they all have one thing in common, stepping off the edge. There was a chance I would fall, but there was also a chance that I would fly.
Yes.
Really nicely put. I know that there was a little bit of tumult, uncertainty, in terms of exactly where in Mexico you were going to end up. Can you just remind me of what that uncertainty was all about? What was going on in Mexico that made your specific placement kind of more uncertain than it otherwise would have been?
Yes. So 10 days before I left, I found out that I would be going to, or I thought I would be going to, a very small rural town in the Sierras of the state of Puebla. And I thought that I was going to be working with the indigenous people there in a library for their youth. And so then I get to Mexico and we have our in-country orientation. And the night before we leave, my country coordinator, who is the ELCA person who coordinates everything, said, I'm not sure that you can go to your site placement because it was so rural that they weren't sure that they would be able to sustain my nut allergy in the event that something happened. So if I were to have gone into anaphylaxis, I would have been so rural in Mexico that I maybe wouldn't have been able to go to a hospital in time. So then I was kind of in limbo for a week, and then I actually began working at a food bank in the state of Tlaxcala when I had my new site placement. And then 2 months in, after my country coordinators had learned my personality and learned that I was strong-willed enough to deal with some of the things that you have to face in a migrant shelter, they told me that I could go to the migrant shelter to work. So it was kind of a three-month journey to get to the migrant shelter, but certainly a reminder that you wind up where you are supposed to be.
Right, so. Right. Well, and that's, of course, what I'm especially excited for us to talk about. One of the things that you talk about repeatedly in the earlier entries of your blog is about that whole experience of sticking out in a place where you just at a glance do not belong. So you are a statuesque 5'10", 5'11", something like this, and blonde, and in no way does your complexion remotely resemble the typical Mexican. So you were sure to attract attention just by walking in the room even before you would begin maybe speaking English or whatever. But what was that experience like? And was it like what you thought it was going to be like? Or did you end up experiencing that in a way that was unexpected?
I had visited Mexico before, so I knew that there would be stairs. But 3 weeks of visiting Mexico versus a year of stairs was a different thing. And so I thought in the town I lived in, I thought maybe people would get used to the token white girl in the town, but they never did.
So they always stared.
They always stared. People would like to touch my hair on buses or public transportation. I once went to get my hair cut, and she said, "I don't know how to cut your hair," because it was so. She said it was so thin, and which I always thought I had a lot of hair, so I don't know. But one of my favorite stories about appearance was when I first was meeting my host mom. I was told to look for the small Mexican woman at the bus station. I thought every woman is a small Mexican woman, and I stood over a foot taller than my host mom, and that was kind of the norm. And so it never got comfortable, but I became comfortable in the discomfort of sticking out. And I also, one of the main things I learned in Mexico is that there's a scale of sticking out. And so there were other people who were U.S. citizens in my country group, but had darker complexion, darker hair, darker eyes. And I was always the one who stuck out because I was tall, very fair complexion, blue eyes. It just, I always stuck out like the sorest thumb.
So on the scale of sticking out, you were towards the very top.
Yes.
Well, what a dubious honor that is.
Yeah.
By the way, if I hope later on we'll have time to talk a little more about the family with which you lived.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading in one of your first blog entries that your host mom asked you to call her mama.
Yes.
Tell us just a little more about the relationship that you ended up forging with your host family.
Yes. So Mexico really values family in a way that was actually isolating in the beginning because I wasn't used to needing to report to people in the way that I had to there. I was used to being more independent, and I wasn't used to entering a room and there being 10 people and I had to go around and do the cheek kiss on all of them and things like that. And so in the beginning, it was actually very difficult to be immersed fully in such a united family front.
Mm.
But it came to be the most rewarding part of my year. And they loved me from day one, and I grew to love them so much. And my host mom was short, but so fiery and spunky, and in that sense, it was a great match.
Cool. So was there a mom and a dad and children? I mean, what kind of family were we talking about?
I just had a mom, and then my host uncles lived very close, my host aunts and uncles. And then I had two host sisters, one who was 6 months younger than me and one who was 6 years older than me. But then I had six female cousins who were within 2 years of me.
Mm.
And they all lived right in the same town. So when I say family, I'm talking aunts, uncles, cousins, anybody.
The whole tree.
Everyone gathers, yes.
Yeah. By the way, what kind of contact were you able to maintain with home in terms of things like email or Skype or phone calls or whatever?
So I was lucky to have Wi-Fi in the home where I lived, which in my original site placement, I wasn't expecting that. So that was kind of an added bonus.
Right.
And so if I wanted to, I could have maintained constant contact with home. But I was responsible in being present and also maintaining the relationships at home.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably a tricky balancing act. Sounds like you handled that very, very well. I know that one of the first places you ended up going were two very, very isolated communities in the state or region, I guess, of Hidalgo, Mexico.
Yes.
And one of the things you said about that, working in this project, which involved trying to bring supplies to the youngsters there, school supplies and whatever, was that these communities were so remote that, as far as you knew, or as far as you assumed, you were maybe the first American person these kids had ever seen.
Yes.
So you might as well have come from Mars.
Yes. It's interesting that you say that, though, because in a way, them never seeing a person like me in media or anything like that meant that they had way fewer preconceived notions of what I was supposed to look like or what I owned or what I bought or education, things like that. They they almost were so shocked and didn't have any idea about America, quote unquote. So they almost were more gracious in meeting me, whereas sometimes other people would be like, you must this because you are white, or you must this because you are American.
Right, making all kinds of assumptions, preconceived notions about what Americans think or what you are like or what you value.
Yes, but I certainly was the first person they had ever seen like I was, and it was almost, it felt like a little bit like I was in a zoo, and they were just all staring like, what, where does this creature come from? We've never seen anything like it.
Wow. For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Annika Barrow, talking about the experience that she had in Mexico, living there for nearly a year as part of an ELCA program called Young Adults in Global Mission. And I invited Annika to come on the program to talk about her experience, because one of the experiences that she ultimately had was working in a migrant shelter, working with people who had fled from their homes in Latin America, and in many cases fleeing for their lives. We'll be talking about that in just a moment. Circling back for just a moment to what you were describing in terms of these young people who had never seen a white person before, had not the slightest notion about what America is or what Americans are like. In sharp contrast to that, in one of your blog entries, you write about seeing a sign someplace, you'll have to remind me where, but a sign that essentially said, keep gringos out of Mexico. Mm-hmm. So first of all, tell us where that sign was, and help us understand, first of all, what those words exactly mean, and what those words meant to you, what it was like to see that sign.
So I saw that sign in my workplace, actually, and someone that I work with had written it out the day after the election to ask me how it felt when somebody displayed something like that. That is so, you know, I didn't choose to be a gringo, which is a white person, or I'm a gringa, but I didn't choose to be that. And so he said, how does it feel when someone in a country that you're living is telling you to get out because you're white?
And they wish you weren't here.
Yes, and that was in backlash to a lot of the rhetoric in the election that said, keep Mexicans out of the U.S. or keep Latinos out of the U.S.
So this person, so this was like a coworker?
Yeah, and I think it was meant kind of lightheartedly, and Mexicans
to make
are
a point.
Very, yes, Mexicans are very blunt, and but, I mean, November was only 3 months into my experience in Mexico, and I was already, you know, so on edge with everything happening in the U.S. because the news was on, and it was America, America, America in the news.
In the Mexican news.
Yes. And so he meant it lightheartedly as a joke and to make a point to me, but it felt so isolating, and was just once again a reminder of what it means to be white in another place, with the freedom to move and the freedom to live there and the freedom to have grace when you can't think of words in Spanish and things like that. He maybe meant it as a joke, but it was a life lesson for
me. Did you tell him how it made you feel, or did you mostly keep those feelings to yourself?
I was so verklempt in the moment that I didn't say anything, but we discussed it later, and I later learned that he, his children are right across the border in Texas.
Oh, boy.
And so he has a very delicate relationship with everything that's happening, because his children are U.S. citizens.
Right.
And he is not.
Yeah.
So
that makes even, that makes even more sense.
Yes.
Fascinating. Speaking of blunt, one of my favorite stories in your blog is from early on, when you meet a Mexican nun by the name of Margarita. First of all, what was going on at that point? It was very early in your stint in Mexico.
So we went from the airport to this convent in Mexico City where we were staying for part of our orientation. And I'm These nuns are a special breed of nuns. They have PhDs. They speak multiple languages. Mm. They are Guadalupanas, which means that they follow the Virgin Guadalupe.
Mm.
And they are philanthropists. They are incredible women. But they don't like nose rings and tattoos is the summary of that story.
So Marguerite told you that very, very frankly. I mean, and basically it was interesting how, as I recall, it was couched in a compliment about how beautiful you are.
Yes, she told me, "Your face is so beautiful. Why are you ruining it with that monstrosity?"
Wow. She didn't hold back.
No, she did not.
Right. But it was interesting. You tell this story not just to tell us, you know, this crazy thing that this strange nun said. That's not at all. I mean, you viewed all of these nuns with great affection, and they in turn with you. I mean, and you couched this story in kind of a greater story about what it means to respect somebody, even when they are different from you or when there are things about them that maybe bother you.
Yes, and all those nuns displayed so much of that. They don't agree with everything. You know, I was certainly not the only one with a nose ring and ear piercings and tattoos, but they still treated us like we were humans. They still made us food that we wanted to eat. They said, "What do you guys want to eat?" You know, and it would wind up on the table at the next meal. And they still respected us, and they still took care of us, and they still treated us like humans, even though there was a lot about us that they maybe didn't agree with.
Or were suspicious of, or bewildered by.
Yeah, or they couldn't see themselves being a person like that. You
right.
know? So there was that.
Reminds me of something else you mentioned in one of these earlier blog entries. I believe it's a TED Talk that you watched or listened to that made a strong impression on you. And the title of it was "The Danger of a Single Story."
Yes.
Can you just expound on that just a little bit?
Well, people should watch. It's "The Danger of a Single Story." It's a TED Talk, and it essentially says that we sometimes see people as one thing and just one thing.
Hmm.
So, for example, the people I work with, I could have just seen them as Latino, and that would mean, you know, I would maybe have preconceived ideas of what it means to be Latino, and I would judge them based on that one thing. Or it's instead of like an intersectional lifestyle, which we all have, because, you know, you're this and you're that and you're all these things, you see it as linear. And so you just see, so people maybe just saw white, or people maybe just saw American.
Right. Or just rich or just poor.
Yes. And so the danger of a single story is that as humans, we always have our first reaction, our first impression of, wow, that person is this because of how they look or something they say. And you have to dig deeper than all of that to figure out all of their stories instead of just their white story or their rich story or their poor story.
And I think it's safe to say that we find ourselves in a situation right now in this country where almost all of us are gravitating towards the single story.
Yes.
I mean, whatever that might be. But it's almost as though we are engaged in a defense mechanism where we want the world to be simpler than it is.
Yes.
And towards that end, we tend to make summary judgments of people, often based on the most superficial of manners, and
yes.
It can get us
or the easiest things to
sure,
see.
Absolutely,
yes.
It's a very lazy and dangerous way for us to regard one another, and that certainly takes us nicely into kind of the major chapter of your experience in Mexico, which was the point when you were assigned to a migrant shelter. First of all, just let's revisit what you said earlier about how at some point somebody in authority there with the program decided that you were ready for this or you were right for this.
I mean, so explain
what this assignment was and how it would not be necessarily an appropriate assignment for just anybody in Yagam.
Yes, yeah, so the shelter sits just beneath the tracks of La Bestia, or the Beast, which is the train that traverses all of Mexico to the United States. So it starts on the Guatemalan-Mexican border, and it goes up to four different entry points on the U.S.-Mexico border. Hmm. And it is a freight train that migrants, they're not supposed to ride, but they ride it through Mexico as a means of transportation. And so every day as the train passes, you are witnessing people getting on and off of a moving train. They are trying to avoid the cement posts that have been put up every 5 feet as they jump on and off. They are sometimes rolling down hills. They are sometimes coming in with injuries that are horrible injuries. And so that part alone, you need to have a certain sense of, you just need to be able to handle it. I can't
right,
think of
yeah,
any,
sure.
way,
I mean, you
any
need,
other way to say
you
it.
You need a stomach of steel, probably. I mean,
yes.
Just to see things that could be quite upsetting.
Yes, yeah. But you're also hearing things that are quite upsetting as these people enter the shelter and are sharing their stories, or you're interviewing them. And so you need to be able to separate a lot in that placement, I think.
Mm.
You can't. You can take it home with you, but you can't take it home with you too much.
Right.
Because it would be very easy to get very sad. And certainly there were times where I was overcome with emotion. But you also have to be able to handle a different culture of men and women based on Latino culture. And so you have to be okay with, not be okay with, but you have to be able to handle and combat people who are saying sometimes inappropriate things to you, like lots of marriage proposals.
Really?
Yes, because people just say, oh, please marry me and help me get to your country, and you just have to laugh it off or be fierce when you need to be fierce, depending on what got said.
Yeah.
And that just is a reality that certainly they wanted to know that I could handle before they put me there.
Right.
It's funny you mentioned appearance, because often my go-to would be, I'm sorry, you're far too short for me to marry you, just because it was kind of, it was a single story thing that I could pick.
Right.
And
quickly.
I was like, you can't argue that, you know,
right.
You can't argue your height with me.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. And so that was
my go-to.
Supposedly a non-starter for issue
yes.
for you. This migrant shelter that was right in a sense beneath the tracks, did you say?
Yeah, so the tracks were on a hill, and it sat kind of in what would be the valley of the hill.
Right. So how many of these migrant shelters are there along this train route?
There are quite a few. I should know the exact number, but I don't. And then there are also places in, not on the tracks, but in, for example, Mexico City, there's a shelter that another Yagam works at that's a long-term shelter, where people who are waiting for like a humanitarian visa or something like that can stay, whereas the shelter where I worked is just a 24 to 48-hour shelter. It's essentially a stopping point to get some food, shower, get help if you need it, and then be redirected to a shelter.
Hmm.
But people also open up their homes and things like that. So the shelter where I work actually was started because people who lived on the tracks began to open up their homes to migrants, and it got to be such a community effort that they opened up the shelter behind the local church.
Mm. So that answers my another question, which is, are all of these shelters under the auspices of a single organization, or in a sense are they more of kind of a grassroots thing that they just spring up in a sense more spontaneously and are owned and operated by different organizations or different churches? I mean,
yeah,
how tightly organized is this?
Well, not very. but it's certainly a combination of those two things. But the shelter where I worked ran purely on donations. So there would be times where we didn't have rice or didn't have beans, and you have to go and ask. And although a lot of people are very supportive of the shelter, there is also a lot of inherent racism between Central Americans and Mexicans.
Really?
And the migrants versus the nationals. There's a large dynamic there of othering.
Mm.
And saying, you know, you are not Mexican. You are not supposed to be here. So although a lot of people are very willing to help, there's also a lot of people who really persecute the migrants for trying to be in Mexico and traveling. And
right. It's interesting. As you were describing that, I immediately assumed that we're talking about Mexicans who have kind of a conflicted feeling about this. That
yes.
That you might approve of this shelter existing and even might work there or, you know, be part of the effort to actually help these migrants, but harboring certain reservations or preconceived notions.
Mm-hmm.
And then the longer you talked, I instead pictured some Mexicans,
yes,
but other Mexicans. I mean, that it's more that Mexicans tend to be one or the other. So
yeah.
So which is it in terms of these sort of these attitudes that you were talking about?
I think it's both. I think I knew people who were very against what I was doing. Mexicans who were like, oh, you work at the shelter, and were not fans of that. But also the people who I worked with and the people who were there working and things like that. And it's interesting because a lot of people who are against it, it's a lot of the same rhetoric that we hear here. You know, they're taking our jobs. They are using our resources. It's the same argument, even though sometimes I think in the U.S. we can group those cultures together, maybe by language or something like that. You know, we often group them together, but there's also a lot of that same divide that we experience between Latinos and the United States. There's a lot of that between Central America and Mexico.
That's fascinating. So from our greater distance, we tend to lump all of that together, or some people do, many
yes.
people do, that it doesn't really much matter if you're from Mexico or Honduras or Peru or wherever.
Yes.
You're just from down there, and
yes.
your skin looks like this, and you speak this particular language. But when you, for instance, live in Mexico, you differentiate in a way that is probably really surprising to the typical American.
Yes. I was very shocked by that dynamic.
Yeah.
Because I had grouped them all as one people, you know, Latin America, Latino culture. But the language is very different. The Spanish language changes. They are very separate entities, which I learned.
Yeah. So when people would exit this train, La Bestia, were they exiting the train, and the train in many cases, maybe most cases, was not stopping.
Correct.
They were leaping off of a moving train.
Yes.
Was it specifically because they knew there was a migrant shelter there?
Yes. So the migrant shelter has a huge painting along the side that says the name of the shelter, which you know is a migrant shelter, and then there's signs all over that say, like, migrant brothers and sisters welcome here, and they know to come to the shelter. And people, when you're at one shelter, the shelter tells you about the next shelters coming, so that is a whole system. And they know, they don't know where it's coming, but they know, oh, I'm looking for Albergue La Sagrada Familia, which was the name. And so when they see that plastered on the side of the wall, they know, oh, I'm here.
And these migrant shelters, these are not in any way illegal, counter to Mexican law or anything. So in other words, they are free to operate above board, so to speak.
Yes. And there are rules about police and migration and whether or not they can enter and for what reasons they can enter and things like that. And there's actually like a 1 kilometer radius around the shelter where migration is not welcome. Yes.
Interesting. So what was the work that you did at this migrant shelter, and how long were you there?
So I was there 9 months, and I did everything and anything. A lot of days I was cooking, so I learned a lot about Mexican cooking, which is very fun. And then other days I was organizing the clothes. Other days I was playing soccer or basketball with migrants, cleaning a lot, registering migrants, which is where you get 10 minutes with them to just figure out where they're going, where they're coming from, any concerns, things like that. Sometimes I treated injuries that I had no medical background to treat. So, I mean, it's really anything and everything that I was doing. But towards the end of my year, I was mainly in the kitchen because I really loved the kitchen and to learn all that.
What did this place look like? I mean, was it old and dilapidated or new and sparkling or something in between?
The former. It didn't even have a roof. So, I mean, the four walls were just concrete walls. And there was an old train car that had a roof put on it with the medical center in one side and the office in the other. But when you're 5'10 like I am, it's pretty hard to move in those. I mean, it is small. And then there's a roof over the kitchen and a roof over the bunkhouse. But most of the shelter is open. So when it rains, everyone is in the bunkhouse area. But that is just like wall-to-wall bunk beds to sleep people. And then there's a very modest bathroom in between. And then on the other side, it's another bunkhouse for women and children.
Hmm. Wow.
But it's modest, very modest.
Right. So you had, for a time, the experience, the responsibility of registering some of these migrants coming into the shelter. What was the purpose of registering them?
It was so that we had a database so that if anyone was ever looking for them, we could say, oh, they were here at this time. And it's also for our safety and our records to make sure that we know who is in there. But in October, they're Central American moms come along the route and look for their sons. And so that's one of the, and daughters, but mostly sons. That's one of the main reasons that we do it is because sometimes we'll get a call from Guatemala of, I'm looking for my son. Hmm. Was he ever at this shelter?
Right. Interesting. And that's, you know, has to be so hard to live with that kind of uncertainty about somebody that you love.
And the journey is also very dangerous, and so it's also people would sometimes come to us with an unidentified body or person, and it's when was this person here? So it's also for things like that.
Wow. It was, I know, an intensely personal experience for you to have these encounters. What are the kinds of questions that you would be asking them?
So, I mean, the basics, name, age, where they're coming from. The most jarring question for me was always, is life in your country dangerous for you? And I, 98% of people that I registered always answered yes. And then the other question that always stuck out to me was, how has your journey been on the train? And hardly ever was there a positive word to come out of that. I mean, people are saying it is cold, it is dangerous, I was shot, I was attacked, I was robbed. I think my foot is broken. I had to walk 20 kilometers. Just those two questions that I can so easily answer with positive things.
About your life.
About my personal life. And just the privilege that is sitting there saying, wow, my answers would be so different.
Right.
And I would never be in this situation.
Right, right. So,
to start with. So those, those were always the hard questions.
Right. Yeah, my trip, I flew on a plane, and they were out of nuts, but at least they had pretzels. That was the hardship of my trip or your trip. And
one of my most sobering moments in Mexico was someone asking me, "How did you get here?" And I just a plane, almost like duh. And then I had to like come to and think like, "Where am I?" That is such privilege to say a plane.
Right, offhandedly, like that's no big deal. One of the really striking stories that people can read in your blog is when you spoke with a young man named Melvin from Honduras. Four of his brothers had been killed there. I mean, he was really in desperate circumstances and so anxious to leave Honduras, had tried once before, and then I think when he was traveling with another young man who became seriously injured,
yes,
they were forced to return to Honduras and so on. But I want you to tell our listeners what this man, young man Melvin, said to you maybe at the end of the conversation that you had in that registration process. Oh, where he said something about, thank you for asking me how I am. It is really nice to feel human.
Oh, yes.
How is it, what is dehumanizing, or what are the most important ways in which so many of these migrants experience, in a sense, dehumanization?
Yeah, Melvin was such a special relationship for me because he was one of the people who was there long term, so I really got to know him. I think so many times when they're going through this registration process or something like that, you know, it probably feels very like, you are migrant number 12 for today. Mm-hmm. It probably feels very much like a number, or you're traveling with people who sometimes you just meet and you don't know each other. You don't know each other's stories, or you're being, you know, migration is seeking after you to hurt you when they don't know you or know why you're leaving. And it's hard to get a humanitarian visa even though you're a refugee. And there are so many moments where these people just feel like they're just there. They're just trying to get by, and no one ever asks anything about where they came from or what it was like. Not just, why are you leaving? Well, my four brothers died. Okay, leave it at that. No, I asked Melvin why they died. How is he doing with that? Does he feel like he needs emotional help? And I think so many people just get the answer for the question that they're after, and they never dig deeper. And that is probably very surface level for these people who have so much hurt and so much angst and are scared and heartbroken. And it just always skates by as his four brothers died.
Right.
It's never any deeper than that.
Right. And they probably have a sense of nobody, never encountering anybody who seems to genuinely care about what they've experienced or what they have suffered. And this was a moment where he spoke up to say how much he appreciated the care with which you were asking him about his life and and about his heart.
And it's sad because it is very easy to hear stories so similar that you almost become desensitized of like, oh, okay, your four brothers died. Type it in, next question.
Right.
It is actually very easy when you are listening to this story or a similar story over and over and over because of the violence in those countries. It's very easy to make it like a check mark on a box. You know, it's just like, oh, yep, done with that question. Move on.
Right, right.
It's very easy to become desensitized.
Right, it becomes that level of horrific violence becomes a terrible new norm.
Yes.
A new normal.
Yes.
That, you know, should remain horrifying to all of us. So you saw and heard a lot in this experience. And again, we'll be directing people to your blog if they want to read more about sort of what you experienced in your 9 months working with these migrants in this shelter. One of your entries talks about this phenomenon of six-word memoirs, which we've actually talked about on the morning show. I've talked to the editor of one of the best-selling collections of the six-word memoir, where you try to summarize yourself or your life in six words. You tell us in your blog that your six-word memoir is, "Keep your doors and hearts open." So I guess my question to you is, as we as a nation wrestle with this complicated question of what to do about all of the immigrants who desperately want to come here, what are the kinds of things that you think we need to be thinking about and talking about that is perhaps getting lost in the debates and discussions that are going on right now?
It's funny that we just talked about humanization, because I think that is probably the top thing, is that at the end of the day, we are all humans, and we should treat each other how we would in turn want to be treated. That's the golden rule. But I often, it's funny because as we've done this interview, I've heard myself saying American over and over and over again. And one of the most valuable lessons I learned in Mexico is that we are all Americans. Latino Americans, Central Americans, South Americans. And as a nation, it is so easy for us to just think that we are it. And this it's very easy to pretend that there's nothing else around the other borders until it becomes relevant, and then it's a wall and things like that, you know. And it, I think it's just very important to remember that we are all humans, and that you never know someone's story until you've spoken to them. And that goes into humanization, right? Like, they're not just a number, or they're not just an immigrant. These people have real stories and real reasons that they're fleeing. I don't think anyone would just get up and get on a train to risk their lives if they didn't absolutely have to.
Right. Yeah, and the notion that somebody is doing that for capricious or shallow reasons, that just doesn't make sense. That's an absurd thing to suggest.
Yes, and I think it's important to remember, too, that these people have lived and experienced more than most of us will ever have to by the time that they even get to the border. And then to get to the border and be faced with, do I go with the cartels to try and guarantee my safety? How do I do this? And it is never out of desire. It is always out of necessity. And I think it's always important to remember that and just walk a mile in other people's shoes, even if it's just in your head. Try and think about what that must be like and humanize them.
Right. Think about them as humans. That is what they are.
Yes.
I think that's a really, really valuable bit of advice. Really quickly, I know you have, I think, remained in some contact with your host family.
Oh, yes.
How hungry are you to go back to Mexico someday?
I'm very hungry, both literally and figuratively, because the food is delicious. But, I mean, these people took me in when I was different. You know, that's the lesson in and of itself, is they treated me as a human. They loved me as a human. They welcomed me with open minds and hearts and doors. And the best thing we can do is to love people the way that my Mexican host family loved me. And that I am very hungry to go back and see them.
And I'm sure they would love to see you again. If you want to read some of what Annika Barrow has written very eloquently about her experience in Mexico, you can visit her blog, which is called Vaya con Annika. Which, what does that literally mean?
Well, it means go with Annika.
Ah.
Yeah, oh. It's a play on like Vaya con Dios, which is
sure.
Go with God. So
yes.
Go with Annika.
Vaya con Annika. And so the website then would be VayaConAnnika. .wordpress.com. I'll say it one more time. VayaConAnnika.wordpress.com. And I promise that you will not be disappointed. Annika is every bit as eloquent and articulate in written communication as she has been in this conversation. Annika Barrow, thank you for joining me to talk about your year with young adults in Global Mission in the heart of Mexico. I really appreciate this. I think this has been a valuable conversation. Thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Again, that was a rebroadcast of a conversation from back in 2018. Monday on the Morning Show, an interview I just recorded with Madeline May Cunin, the first woman elected governor of the state of Vermont and the author of a beautiful memoir about growing old called Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. On Tuesday, Elizabeth Emmons, author of an interesting book called Life Admin, How I Learned to Do Less, Do Better, and Live More. On Wednesday, tentatively scheduled is Mick Burke, business reporter for the Racine Journal-Times, with an update on Foxconn. On Thursday, Nan Calvert's first visit to the morning show in 2019 with Vicki Elkin from the Fund for Lake Michigan. And a week from today, Associate Professor of Political Science Gerald Mast from Carthage College. We'll see a week from today if this government shutdown is still in effect, and we'll otherwise talk with Professor Mast about this new Democratic